How's it going, everyone? Welcome back to Cubeldcast. In this podcast, we have a special guest who develops games despite having a disability.
Yes.
And we'll give it right to Michael right now. We'll let him introduce himself.
Hey, I'm Michael. You may know me as the lead programmer at Trixel Creative working on Restitched, but that's not the only game I work on. I work on my own game called Socially Distant, and I do it all while blind.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
You know, before we get into everything, I know a lot of people, including myself, are kind of ignorant about what that actually means. Like, even a few months ago, I thought that meant 100% can't see anything. And so I know there's a lot of nuance to that. Would you mind explaining that a little bit?
So, obviously, like you said, when people think of blindness, they think absolute 100% can't see anything. Everything's black or everything's white. Nothing's there. But it's actually a spectrum. So you can have different levels of blindness. For example, some people, they may struggle to see things far away or things close up. They may be near farsighted. Some people might struggle with peripheral vision, color vision, night vision, all that sort of stuff. For me, it's kind of everything combined, but I still have some eyesight left. It's just not really a whole lot.
What about colors? Like color?
Color is interesting for me because, like, I can obviously see in color. Like, I can tell the difference between red, green, and blue, but certain shades of green, for example, blue to me, or certain shades of blue look green, certain shades of red look brown, and it completely depends on the context and where things are next to each other. Like, if I'm looking at a traffic light at nighttime and there's like nothing to really go off of, the green light, I only know it's green because someone taught me it was green. It looks blue to me.
Huh. Interesting.
I'm curious. I think you may have told me before, Michael, that is it true that your vision degrades or is degrading?
So, yes and no. And what I mean by that is I was born with a genetic disability or defect or something. I don't know what to call it. I'm really nervous right now, but I was born with something called retinitis pigmentosa, and up until very recently that was a big concern, but I've actually been treated for it since then, thanks to a surgery that was really experimental and only just became approved in Canada. And it's not meant to make me any less blind. It's meant to stop the progression of the disease so that hopefully I don't get any more blind. Or if I do, it's very slow and a lot more manageable than it would have been.
Wow. Was that a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, that was actually not long before I appeared on the previous podcast with you guys with Trixel. Was just getting out of recovery by that point.
Wow. It's great to hear.
Have you noticed a difference at all? I know he said it doesn't actually fix anything.
I have noticed a very slight difference in night vision, which they expected that would probably happen. Like, I don't get any visual acuity back, so things are still just as hard to see and read as they used to be. But at nighttime, I do notice that my computers light up the whole room blue, whereas before it would only light up a section of my room and the rest would be pitch black. That's I've just become ever so slightly more sensitive to light at night, and that means that I can pick out maybe not full detail, but I can at least see relatively where I am and what's around, which is really helpful at night.
That's actually super interesting. It's kind of hard to imagine what that would be like. Do you wear glasses or like some sort of special glasses?
I wear a very strong prescription. It would probably give you a massive migraine the moment you put the glasses on. But at this point, I don't even think I can go any further with the prescription. But they don't really help as much as I would like them to when it comes to reading. But the important part is when I'm outside in the sunlight, they have transition lenses so that I can actually, you know, see without feeling like my retinas are on fire.
Mm-hmm. Do your glasses turn into sunglasses when you go outside? I know some sunglasses, that's cool. Mm.
I know during the Trixel podcast, you were talking about some of the games you play, but what other types of media do you like to enjoy?
Mostly music and YouTube, but I don't generally watch YouTube. I mostly listen to it. Mm. Call me weird if you want, but I am actually one of the people who unironically listens to Reddit TTS videos because they're just calming.
I mean, yeah, it's relevant for you. Like, the other people can just go on, and I think we all take that for granted, mm-hmm. being able to just scroll and read.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I've used Reddit with text speech during my recovery, and it is absolutely not usable, especially in mobile, because there's so much going on, and if people format their posts weirdly, the screen reader craps out and doesn't read the message properly, or it'll read something in the background. It's just super buggy. And Reddit is not the only app that's like that, which is concerning, but it is what it is.
It's kind of crazy to think about that you listen to a lot of like text-to-speech type of stuff like that, and us, like, we generally get annoyed at those just because the text-to-speech just sounds so odd.
I don't know if any of you have used Microsoft Edge, but every once in a while I accidentally press a button that turns text-to-speech on, and one of the voices is this little kid voice, and it's actually a really accurate sounding voice. Like, it doesn't sound like it's a robot. So sometimes, like, you go to some funny Wikipedia page and have the little kid read it, and it's hilarious.
Oh, I remember you doing that with, like, some very morbid...
It was
like
some meme or something, yeah. But, I don't know, sometimes I turn it on and just, like, listen to this little kid talk about, like, you know, serious topics or something. It's kind of funny.
I'm also curious. This isn't even in our notes. We're just kind of, like, bouncing off each other right now. All three of us are very much, like, in the online space. So, one thing that I deal with day to day, and I know that Jay and Caleb do too, is ADA compliance. So I'm curious if you've run into, like, while you're browsing or you're on a website, does that ever become a hindrance where you're like, wow, this website sucks and I can't do anything on here because, you know, the developers or the people haven't taken any consideration into, you know, ADA compliancy?
It completely depends on the site and the browser. The worst thing for me is getting those CAPTCHAs, because AIs have gotten so capable of solving them, especially the really basic ones where it's just character recognition, that you can't even get an audio version of the CAPTCHA. So some of the CAPTCHAs now, what they'll do is they'll make you get this accessibility cookie that's emailed to you, and it expires after like a few months, and you have to go through this whole rigmarole just to sign into your password manager, for example, and it's so annoying. But once I actually get signed into everything, most of the time it's fine, because I have my dark reader going, I have my own extension that handles screen reading for me, so I can highlight text. But it's just that initial setup that's like really annoying, because I have to get everything put into place to make things work, which I really wish that websites just respected dark mode by default without an extension, and I wish that browsers had screen readers built into them without an extension. But other than that, it's fine.
You said earlier you were on Linux. Isn't that a lot harder to use than Windows for something like that?
Well, yes and no. Luckily for me, I was able to get into Linux and super familiar with it back when I still had a lot more of my eyesight and could read. But also, a lot of the mainstream distros have gotten a lot better with accessibility. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of issues with it still. But Ubuntu, for example, they have text-to-speech set up by default. There's a default hotkey you can press to zoom in and out. You have your dark mode, you have your high contrast, you have your large font. It's all there. And then you have distros like Arch where you have to set it up yourself, but it can be done. So it is definitely a lot better than it used to be, I'll say that much. I'd say it's not quite on par with Windows, but it's close.
That's surprising. I feel like every time I try to use Linux, there's always some random issue. Like I was messing with the Steam Deck, something on there recently. I was doing it for like 2 hours and should have been a basic task. You know, you like click three things and then it's supposed to appear there, but it never did. And I never figured it out. It took me forever.
Huh. Wait, this is kind of a rabbit trail, but you mentioned Linux versus Windows.
Mm-hmm.
The past day, the ROG Ally came out, which is the other handheld, and has Windows 11 on it. And people are saying the Steam Deck killer. All this. Sorry, Michael. This is kind of not entirely relevant, but basically they were saying the Steam Deck killer, and they were saying all these different things about how it was going to destroy it. And the battery life is a lot worse.
What is it? How is it? I mean, the Steam Deck doesn't. If you're playing a AAA game, you get like 2 hours, maybe, or three.
On the Steam Deck?
Yeah, if you're playing like a heavy.
Yeah, but it's worse than that, though. So let's say, I think they actually tested it on a bunch of games. And the main one that I saw was Stardew.
What?
Stardew Valley. The Steam Deck gets about 7 hours. The Switch gets about 6 hours on a full battery. And the ROG Ally gets 3.5.
Wow. Is that because of the Windows bloat?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the 120 hertz screen. But yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know why they put Windows on it. I mean, SteamOS is available to license.
Yeah.
Probably.
Sure.
It is basically just Linux. Why not just use that?
I mean, I'd say and Windows has the money to make their own OS if they really wanted to.
Yeah.
Windows is like really horrible on a handheld, and I know it because I've tried it. It's not designed for that.
Mm-hmm.
It never was.
Yeah. Well, even on a laptop, Windows is kind of annoying.
Yeah, but at least then you have your touchpad and your physical keyboard, but you're not navigating true, yeah. Windows with a gamepad unless there's like special drivers put into place. And even then, it's buggy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Michael, you have a Steam Deck, right?
Yeah,
I have it
right behind me.
How does that work out for you? Like that OS?
I mean, it is Linux, and it does run KDE, which is the most accessible desktop environment on Linux. But the game scope or whatever UI they use for the actual Steam client it's a little hard for me to read because the font's a little too small, but I can get around it. I mean, I can, if I really need to blow it up onto a big screen, I can just plug my Steam Deck into my dock and it'll bring it up onto my 32-inch monitor and then I'll be able to read it fine.
When I was doing the other day on the Steam Deck, I plugged it into the 4K monitor and the UI was scaled super small. It was a 4K TV, like a 15-inch TV or something, and I was far away. I had to get up within like 2 feet of it to be able to read the actual text. And I even scaled some of the UI and some of it didn't scale properly. So like some of it was readable and others I had to actually go close to the screen to see.
Yeah, the file manager.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, tiny. That would be Wayland and KDE for you. It's not perfect yet, but it is usable. If you stick to like 1080p and something like that. I know with my dock, the max it'll do, because it's not the Steam Deck dock, it's like an old one that I bought for college. It'll only do 1080p, and that's honestly fine for me.
Hmm.
Before we get into a lot more of this, I do want to say quickly, Michael, I'm so sorry this isn't relevant to you, but we saw Guardians of the Galaxy on Thursday night, and it was absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like old prime Marvel days good. And it was like, it was like a bittersweet moment where, I don't know if you guys felt this too, but like, it was so sad that it was the last one, because like, I grew up on those, but it was also like a good moment because it was such a good movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you get into really Marvel at all, Michael?
No.
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. I have been under a restitched code rock for the past like 2 years.
Are you able to go to the movies? Like, does it help that it's on a bigger screen?
I don't really like watching movies, to be honest.
It's like Ben.
I mean, I did watch Top Gun Maverick, a year ago. That was pretty cool. But the problem with going to a movie theater for me is I have to go with family because it's too dark to navigate on my own in there. And I find that the movie theater screen, although it's bigger, I find the colors to be a lot more washed out, and it's harder to tell what's going on unless I have someone there to describe it to me. And then, you know, we're in a theater with lots of people who are trying to watch the movie, and having someone narrate everything going on, that's not exactly pleasant for everyone around you. And if I'm at home, I can't sit and watch a movie for 2 hours. I have to be doing something, programming, playing games, occupying myself. Otherwise, it's not fun for me. So,
how about podcasts?
They're perfectly fine in the background when I'm programming or when I'm trying to sleep, but I wouldn't be able to sit there and
listen to one.
Yeah.
We're kind of the same. I'm somewhat of the same way, though. Like, I'll be working all day, and I have to have something in the background. Like, even if it's a stupid, like, just YouTube, random YouTube video. Like, it's nice to have something on the other monitor just playing while you're focusing on something.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling Chug the other day, sometimes I have, like, 3 or 4 videos playing in the background. And I'm focusing on one, but there are multiple playing. And, like, I tune the other ones out.
I don't know how you do
that. I don't know if it's an ADHD thing or not, but it's, I don't know, something I find myself doing frequently. And I'm like, oh, I got to close some of these videos down.
I think the YouTube thing is, it may be a flaw in our generation. Because, like, Michael, I don't know if you have the same thing, but, like, for me, whenever I whenever I make my food, I, like, quickly get to my setup. And I go on YouTube, and I have to find a video to watch before I can start eating. Like,
I'm the exact same way. I'll get home from Tim Hortons or something, and I'll immediately get to my computer and just, okay, we'll put the sandwich down, we'll put the coffee down, and get some YouTube going.
Yeah.
And your food, if you like warmed it up, it's like cold by the time you find it.
You gotta go microwave it.
Oh, come on.
When you can't find a good one, it's like annoying. Like, I can't eat until I like have something.
That's awesome.
Isn't Tim Hortons like a Canadian Dunkin' Donuts?
I guess so. I mean, I don't really know much about Dunkin' Donuts. We don't really have it here. We have Tim Hortons. Yeah,
I don't think we have Tim Hortons here.
No. Is that Horton?
I thought there was one, but it shut down. Kind of like, I know there was a, something. What was that? The Southern Donut place? Krispy Kreme. Yeah.
We had Krispy Kreme.
There was one that was up in North New England, but I think it shut down because nobody went to it. But it's kind of like there are Dunkins. There's no Dunkins in the South because nobody went to that, and they all went to Krispy Kreme. So it's like this weird thing where
there's a lot of chains that exist in the South that don't in the North, in the Northeast.
What is that other one? The Chick-fil-A clone? Not clone, but
Bojangles.
Bojangles.
I feel like Bojangles might have been around before. Sorry, Michael. This is so random. You're probably like, what's happening?
This is all of our podcast.
Well, Bojangles is amazing, though.
Bojangles is
they
so
give you
good.
So much portion.
Yeah.
Like, when we went there in North Carolina, they give me a giant iced tea that was like this big.
Mm-hmm. It's like Chick-fil-A and Popeyes combined.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's literally what Bojangles is.
So much fried food.
It's so bad for you, but
it's so American.
There's a reason why that area is called the Stroke Belt.
Oh man.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny. Anyway, yeah, the Guardians of the Galaxy was amazing. Definitely watch it if you haven't already.
They took a lot from the game, which I mentioned to you guys that it's not everything. There's a bunch of stuff that's different in the game. So if you guys do play it, there are like surprises and different things. Like you won't, well, you're watching the movie won't spoil the game for you, but they took a lot from the game and probably the comics. Which
so many games
cool.
to play right now.
Yeah, I heard
so
the game got like, on. What was it? Like almost like a, was it overwhelmingly positive on Steam?
I think it got very positive. I don't think it got overwhelmingly, but it was still really good. It was actually a surprise because the same people who did the Avengers game, which is surprising.
Oh, wow.
People were actually like skeptical at first.
Yeah.
Of the game, but it was pretty good.
Sorry to bore you with a Marvel talk, Michael.
All good.
Besides developing stuff for Restitched, what other projects have you been involved with or working on?
So, like I mentioned in the intro, I'm also working on my own hacking game called Socially Distant. But alongside that, I've been working on a tool for Linux that lets me use my Stream Deck on Linux to control OBS, because that's not something you can do natively right now. And I've also been working on a few smaller, I kind of want to try something else out type of projects. One of them was Airflow, which is basically if you take Sonic Riders and turn it into a typing game. Don't know how I managed to pull that off, but it's fun. I never released this, but I also made a rhythm game that's also a typing game for some reason, and it's also a programming simulator, which is, I mean, I have not released it yet because it's a rhythm game, and a rhythm game without any music is not exactly a game, but I've been working on quite a lot, and I've actually been learning a lot too, especially from Trixel and Socially Distant as well.
You said it's a hacking game? Is it kind of like HackNet? Do you ever play that?
HackNet, I've also played Uplink once or twice, but the UI is not very accessible to me. It's like, I believe that game came out in like 2001 or 2 or something like that. So obviously it's not going to be the most accessible.
What about that other game? It's called Do Not Play the Game or something. Isn't that another hacking game? Or am I thinking
I think
of something different?
Game.
I don't know if I've
heard of that one.
So obviously we know that you work on Restitched and your own game Socially Distant, but I'm kind of curious if you can give us a quick summary on how you got where you are today. Because, you know, I'm listening to this and, you know, you're obviously very intelligent. You work on a lot of stuff and you're a pretty high level programmer. I mean, you know your stuff. So how did you get to where you are today, and where did it begin? Like, at what point did you start programming?
So it began when I was around 9-10 years old in grade 2, because that was around the time when we started noticing that something was wrong with my eyes. We didn't know what, but we did get it tested and stuff like that. And eventually my teacher had me start doing work on a computer in front of the class. We didn't have laptops or things like that. Like Chromebook didn't exist back then either. So we had two desktops in front of the class, and one was for the teacher and one was, well, mine. And I would get on there, do all my notes and all my work and all that stuff. And if I needed to look at the board, which was something I struggled with, it was a smart board. It was hooked up to the teacher's computer. So I would just sit at the teacher's computer and help drive the lecture and be able to see the notes on the screen. But then in grade 4, obviously that became a little less sustainable because more advanced topics and more work and stuff like that. So the school set me up with a laptop, and by then I was also diagnosed. So the laptop gave me a lot of time to play around, because when you're sitting in front of the class on a computer that's not yours to use all the time, you have to share it with other people. You can't really explore what it can do. You kind of just do your work and get off it. But when I had the laptop, I could, for example, use it during free time or while I'm done my assignment and everyone else is working. So I got very familiar with all the programs on it and what it could do. And in grade six, I found out that it actually had a whole bunch of programming IDEs on it. And one of them was actually Visual Basic. And if you know anything about Visual Basic, you'll know that its main feature is that you can create a project and drag and drop UI elements onto the screen and build an application almost without writing any code. And the code you do write is super simple and really easy to learn. And so I was bored in math class one day and done all my work. And I just made my own web browser because you can drag a web browser onto the window and tell it to go to google.com and boom, you've built a web browser. It's based on Internet Explorer, but it works. And that was the first Windows program I ever wrote. And then it all went on from there. I worked on a operating system simulation game that I'm not very proud of that I worked on because it was not very a fun game, but I did work on it. That's where I learned how to do a lot of game dev stuff and more advanced programming. Switched to C# in 2016. I learned a little Unreal Engine in 2018. I did some dual credits at the local college for game dev from 2018 to 2020. And then by that point, I was writing my own game engines from scratch, and I was using C++ and C# and all these other programming languages, and it just kept on going. And then around the time when the Little Big Planet servers shut down on PS3 because of the hacking, I found out about Restitch and went from there.
Wow.
That's really interesting. I have some familiarity with programming stuff, nowhere near as much as you have, I'm sure. But how did the whole disability factor into learning that stuff?
Well, I will say that if I didn't need the computer in grade three, I would not have discovered programming at all. So that's a big factor of it. And obviously, if I weren't blind, I wouldn't have needed the computer. It's as simple as that. So you say that me being blind is the whole reason I became a programmer? I mean, I wouldn't have discovered it otherwise. But as far as how being blind affects my ability to learn programming, back then it didn't really. I mean, I couldn't learn from books, but that was okay because we had the internet. I was lucky enough to be able to find things like Stack Overflow, and I believe Dream in Code was another forum that I used to visit a lot back when I was running Visual Basic. And then, you know, Microsoft, the MSDN documentation at the time was very thorough, and there were a lot of tutorials on how to do things. And back then, when I was learning VB, Visual Studio, I don't know if they have it now, but back then they had this section where you could download online templates with sample code and sample programs that you could play around with. And they were just there in the IDE. So like you had little test programs like a text editor and stuff like that that you could mess with. And that's kind of how I learned, by just experimenting with that stuff.
Have you experimented with any of the newer AI stuff like GitHub, Copilot, or even just ChatGPT for programming?
I have used ChatGPT a few times in my programming. I don't find a lot of those tools useful to me because, I mean, they're fun to play with, don't get me wrong, and they do have their uses, but for me, I don't really need something to suggest code to me as I'm typing. The most I need is a little menu that says, hey, you're working with this object, here's what it can do, and here's what variables are on it. That's all I really need because I can just rely on documentation and stuff like that. Where the AIs really help me out is when I'm trying to figure out some sort of problem in math. And I'm not very good with math. That's the surprising thing, that I'm a game dev who sucks at math. I hate math. I can't do it. It's horrible. It's the worst thing ever. But a lot of people like it. And, you know, the AIs, they can work with it very well. And there was one feature in Restitch that was working on that required some weird trigonometry thing that I just couldn't figure out how to do. And I asked ChatGPT, hey, given this point in space, this list of points in space, and this angle I want to rotate them by, how do I write a program that rotates all the other points around the center point? And it just spat out the code, and it worked.
Wow.
That was really helpful. But I think that was like the only time I've ever used an AI to help me program directly. Most of what I do is just completely from memory or Stack Overflow.
I don't know if you guys are getting the same feeling, but like, we have a couple friends that we know that are, they're like engineers, and whenever they talk about whatever they're doing, it's like, as they're spitting out all this stuff, it's like, I kind of just sit there and think of how much smarter they are than I am. And it's kind of the same thing with you talking about all these programming, and you're like, yeah, that's when I was learning this, and then I hopped to this, and I'm learning this now. And it's like this, I'm getting the same feeling that you're like, you're one of those programmers that are like way up there, or at least it seems so from, because I don't have a lot of, you know, I don't really.
I can definitely think of way smarter people than me.
Well, it's still extremely impressive.
Yeah. A few months ago, I only started using ChatGPT a few months ago, that in GitHub Copilot. Once I discovered that for coding, because I've been coding for a long time, just like purely for fun, like off and on, nothing major. But once I discovered that, I went crazy with it. I was developing like programs all over the place, just like, oh, like how can I make my life easier here? I'll develop a JavaScript program that just runs in a web browser, and then just go on there, have it do its thing, and then it simplifies something of my online work. And I made like dozens of things that have been helping me. But it's funny to hear you say like, oh yeah, it's so easy for you, you don't need any of that stuff. Like,
no. I don't need any of that stuff. I can definitely understand if other people do need those tools, and it's great that those tools are available. But for me personally, I just don't see the point when I can write the code myself and it'll probably run at least as well, if not better, than what the AI would come up with, unless it's something really esoteric or something related to math, in which case I'm screwed.
Yeah, I found out the biggest hurdle for me for programming was like, let's say I got stuck on one part of the code, and I would sit there for hours trying to figure it out. Well, ChatGPT, I could figure it out in minutes. So it actually really simplifies things for me. And it took a lot of the frustrating parts out of it. So it was actually more enjoyable to code.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine that. I definitely run into the situations where I'm stuck on some piece of code that isn't doing something I expected it to do. All the time. And for me, my solution to that is just go work on something else for a little while, or go to sleep and come back to it. And usually I end up figuring it out eventually. But I can definitely see the AI being helpful there, because it can look at the code and it can be a second pair of eyes for you. And, you know, it's also a computer, so it probably understands the code a little bit more than most programmers do. I would hope. But also, I mean, if I really need help with a piece of code, luckily I have other programmer friends who can do that for me. And that's something that you, if you're learning to program, definitely find other programmer friends to talk to about it. Because most of the time, if you're polite and you've explained what you've tried, they're going to help you. Just stay off of Stack Overflow. Don't ask questions on there ever.
Oh yeah. Sometimes I'll go on there for an answer to a problem, and
oh yeah, if you're going for answers, it's fine. Just never ask questions.
Yeah, there's like a dozen solutions and like you're not sure if any of them even work.
Yeah.
So it's a little annoying sometimes.
Yeah, you mentioned Trixel Creative before. I know this question is probably, you could be as vague or as detailed as you want, but it says, what are you currently up to with Restitched? I know you're probably can't give much information, but
so right now I will say I'm taking a break. I wanted to work on Socially Distant for a week. But before the break, you know, I could say everything I was working on because it's all in the latest recap. I was working on the main menu, which was interesting. I learned a whole lot about UI and something called MVVM, which I'm not going to try to explain. It's a little bit, if you're not a programmer, it's a little bit technical. But suffice to say, it makes making a user interface with dynamic content a whole lot easier. And I also worked on, fairly recently, the Restitched toolbar and some of the new build mode UI for it. And, you know, making the game work in such a way where you can actually load into a main menu. Because before you couldn't. There was no way in the code to do it. Now you can. And I've really just been working on a lot of the low-level plumbing of Restitched and all the stuff you don't really get to see as a player, but also some things you do see, like the main menu. And it's been fun.
Those are some of the most important parts, though. I think people take for granted what you can't see. And as soon as something goes wrong, then they notice it.
Like, yeah,
they get mad at the devs for, you know, not coding it right or whatever, but like they don't know how much work went into actually doing what was done.
Yeah, because like you think of a game like Cyberpunk, where one of the big bugs with it was that NPCs would just disappear right in front of you because of memory management. That kind of bug is legitimately difficult to solve, especially when you're working across multiple platforms with vast amounts of hardware resources to work with. Taking a game that's supposed to run on a PS5 and making it fit on a PS4 is not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. And I look at those bugs and it's like, yeah, they kind of suck that they went out, but it's not the dev's fault. It takes a while to debug those things and figure out, why is this NPC disappearing when I'm looking directly at him? Like, why is this happening? Those bugs are annoying. The real people you should blame when you run into that is the publisher, because the publisher was rushing the devs. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that.
I'm kind of curious, Michael. So last week we played Redfall, which I'm sure you heard of. The game was awful. I mean, it had so many issues. You know, the AI was really bad. It fell flat in almost every way. From a programmer's perspective, I don't know how much you've read up on it, but like, why does stuff like that, I mean, obviously there's crunch culture, but like, what's your thought on that release?
Well, I can't talk specifically on that release because I just don't know anything about it. But in general, most of the time it's crunch culture. A lot of the time it's devs not getting paid enough. Because what a lot of programmers will do is, if they're being rushed and not paid enough to care, they just don't care. They get the thing working and they leave it at that. And working can be very loose. Sometimes it's a matter of the program just wasn't tested, because when you're programming, you get into this sort of tunnel vision, unless you're like really skilled and can really plan for everything that could possibly go wrong. And I'll be honest, you won't even get that far. It's very difficult to plan for everything the player could do. But you know, you get into this tunnel vision of implementing your feature, and you test the things that you know need to work in the ways that you expect them to work. Sometimes programmers don't do that. And if they do, oftentimes it's not thorough. And that's why we used to have, and some companies thankfully still have, QA, quality assurance. Those people, their entire job is to do every possible thing in the game to break it. And if they break it, they report it. And that ideally happens before release. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there is no QA. Sometimes the players are the QA. And I really find that annoying, because that's also, in a way, what Microsoft Windows is.
That's probably exactly what Redfall did.
Yeah. I'm so surprised. I can't imagine a development process without QA. Because I've been on various like massive web development jobs and I hated the QA people because all they would do is report things are wrong, but that's their job. So it's like, yeah. It's hard to think that a game could go out without QA.
Yeah, but who is testing this? Like, let's say Redfall. Say, oh, yeah, this is horrible, but yeah, we still have to put it out anyways. Who's testing it?
They may not have had
literally
QA.
Saying, oh, yes, it's go time to release this.
Sometimes with QA, the people are overbearing and they get upset when they report issues. So they start saying like, okay, well, we'll just not going to report issues. We'll say, yeah, that's good. They just say yes to everything and then it gets through and then they don't realize it's bad until they release it to the players.
Mm.
Yeah. Ultimately, you are relying on a human and, you know, humans are going to sometimes not use proper judgment and they're going to look at a bug and go, eh, I don't feel like reporting this. It's fine.
I mean, the other thing could be, I've had experiences before, but ticket backlog. So like the QA guys would put out.
Oh, that too.
A
that
ton
too,
of tickets,
for sure.
But then you're getting so close to launch date that those tickets are just backlogged. And it's like, oh, yeah. We'll come out with a patch in like a month or so.
Yeah, like once you get super close to release, it's like, okay, this red cube should be blue. Who cares?
Yeah.
Oh, the game crashes when you run into this wall. We should probably fix that.
Yeah.
And that's the point of early access, is to help smaller studios do that with a larger player base.
Yeah.
Like, recently, Sons of the Forest did this, and they've been releasing huge updates every 2 weeks.
Yeah, but they did it in a good way, though.
But Redfall's not a small studio.
I'm not excusing
part.
Redfall. I'll never excuse that.
But there were a bunch of games. Like, the first one was Callisto Protocol back in December.
That was just bad performance, right?
Yeah, but it was because they released it early.
There were glitches too, right? I think I remember someone streaming and it was.
Oh, yeah. That was so stuttery. And then I'm trying to think, what were the other ones? There was Wild Hearts that came out in February. That one was bad. Apparently, that was really bad. Mm-hmm. Then there was Last of Us Part 1 that came out on PC in March. And then Redfall. Those are like the four really, really bad releases of this year.
Mm.
I'm curious to know more about your game, Michael. So you said it's a hacking game, like maybe kind of like Hacknet, or is it something different?
I mean, Hacknet is a huge inspiration for it. I know the person who made Hacknet. I talk to them semi-regularly.
Hmm.
Matt Trabiani, you're cool. I like you. But I want to go a little more advanced than Hacknet with the hacking mechanic, but also it's not completely focused on hacking. It's more, you're not just hacking computers and socially distant, you're also hacking humans. So there's a social engineering aspect with NPCs and stuff like that. Like, I'm adding a chat system to the game, kind of like an RPG dialogue system. And I'm also adding, one of my ideas for some of the hacking missions is like, well, think of it. You have your computer, but also it's 2020. You have a phone and your phone is a smartphone. It connects to the internet. And, you know, maybe you're an essential worker and you work at this bank that the player wants to rob. And, you know, banks are all digital now. Your money is literally just a number in a database. So, you know, one of the things you could do as a player, if you want to hack into the bank, you find the employee through social media. You find some way into their home network, which is probably going to be less secure. Let's be honest. Most people have UPnP turned on. And if you know anything about UPnP, you should have it turned off. So you get into the employee's phone and then you can drop a little remote access tool on it. Wait for them, use GPS to track them on the map, wait till they get into the bank where their phone automatically connects to the Wi-Fi, and then you have remote access into the bank's network, and then you can do your hack. And, you know, how would you get the remote tool on the phone? You would fish the NPC, and then they click on a link, and then they download something sketchy, and they run it.
That sounds
because
just
people
like
do that.
the plot of the show Mr. Robot. I don't know if you've seen that.
That sounds familiar.
I have not.
It's a hacking show, but they do a lot of social engineering. Well, they'll find like the weakest employee there, and then they'll find their personalities and exploit it, and then find a way for them to make mistakes, and then they get in, hack the whole bank or whatever. Just like crazy stuff like that.
That's terrifying.
And there's a reason they go for that in the show, because that is hacking in real life nowadays.
Yeah.
99% of the major breaches today are breaches of the human. Ransomware is not going to execute unless someone runs that executable and it has some spreading mechanism in that takes advantage of another vulnerability to spread. You need that first person to run it. You're not going to get your account stolen by just someone hitting a hack button. You have to give the credentials. You have to run something that steals them. They have to be stored in an insecure way in the first place, which is down to human incompetence of the person who wrote the programs you use. You know, a lot of hacking nowadays is not just, I have this computer I want to get into and this program that can get into it. I'm going to run the program, wait for the little animation to complete, and, you know, I'm in. No, you got to exploit the human mind first and get someone to run something, get someone to click a link, get someone to plug something in, you know, get someone to open a door for you and follow them in. You know, a lot of cybersecurity jobs nowadays involve physical penetration of a building. You test the physical security of a building. What doors can you get into? Can the locks be picked? Is there any way you can get through a door in a way that people wouldn't expect? Can I plug something into the network and get remote access? What can I get access to? You know, what can I steal without people questioning me? Do people question me if I walk in with a clipboard? You know, all sorts of stuff like that. That's hacking.
You know a little too much about this, don't you, huh?
Don't open it.
I am probably not on our CMP watch list now, but you know what? Most of what I know is from other hacking podcasts.
If you send me a link, I'm going to be very suspicious about that.
Yeah.
Everyone in the Trixel community, don't open anything for Michael.
If the URL ends with .exe and it was sent by me, it was probably not sent by me. Don't click it.
There was one time I got a link from one of our friends that I clicked, and I got my entire Steam account stolen.
By a single click?
A single click. Because I had my Steam account logged in on my browser.
Oh. Huh.
So basically, that's why I don't save anything on my browser anymore. I just have everything in a password manager.
It instantly changed the password.
It changed the password, and it got through 2FA, two-factor authentication.
What?
Like, I don't know how it did that.
Was that through email or something? Through your browser?
No, it was through Discord.
No, someone sent you
Was it on Steam?
Yeah.
It was in the Steam Messenger.
They had also sent me the same link, and I'm like, I immediately told them they had gotten hacked.
But yeah.
Then I told you, and you're like, oh, I clicked the link.
Yeah, and I looked, and I tried signing in, but how I fixed it was I went to Steam support, and basically they used an IP from like Russia to sign in, and I was like, yeah, that is not me. So they changed around the password, and then like turned off 2FA. I signed in, changed my password, and then re-enabled 2FA. So don't click links,
and don't save your passwords in your browser either.
Yeah.
And I have my own story of how I got hacked a few years ago. Back when I was in high school, you know, probably not safe to admit this, but I used to bypass the school's firewall and be able to access sites that were blocked. And the way I would do that is I would set up, or a friend would set up a VPS for me, which is a little virtual machine that runs in the cloud. You can connect to it from anywhere. And I would run a VNC server on it, which is a remote desktop server, and I would connect to it through my browser, enter a password, and you know, I have this little Linux computer that I can remote into and do whatever I want in, and the school's none the wiser because they haven't found the remote desktop tool I'm using yet, and they haven't blocked it. And they can't see what I'm doing on the Linux computer because it's a different computer, not on their network. And I would do this to get onto Discord so that I could, you know, talk with college professors and stuff like that during my dual credit, because that's where we talked. But Discord was blocked. And I'd remote in, and stupidly, I'd leave the connection open with it logged into my account. And the thing with VNC and some of the VNC servers you can use is they have a password length limit of 8 characters, which should be the minimum, not the maximum. Like, if your password is smaller than 8 characters, change it now. Someone brute forced the password and logged in remotely to that little Linux server and started spamming my Discord server as me because they had full admin.
Wow. How did you fix that?
I can't even remember how I managed to get back into the account. I don't think they changed the password because they couldn't. Yeah, they couldn't change the password because it was a remote desktop session. It was already logged in. Why change the password? And even then, you need the existing Discord password to change it. So all I had to do was wait for them to be done with the account because, you know, they're not going to be able to change anything with it. I had 2FA turned on and everything. Wait till they get off the server and just shut down the server, and then they lose access, and then I'm fine. The only way they got in was because of that VNC server having such a weak password and being already logged into my Discord account. If I had logged out of the Discord account, I would have been fine. If I'd logged out of the Linux account, I would have been fine. But because I had everything logged in and I just put the desktop to sleep, essentially, that's how they got in. And, you know, it was dumb on my part to do that. I should have not had it logged in and should have been a little more careful.
It's amazing how there are people just kind of all over the place that will take advantage of every little opportunity like that. Like, what do they do all day? They just sit in their room and, you know, look for people to hack into their Discord server and spam stupid stuff.
It's like that generic meme with the kid with the mouth harp. He put the glasses on and he was like in front of the PC with the green text like running down on the screen.
It's always like that in the movies where they're like, I'm hacking into the mainframe. It's like they push one button and it's like runs a thing.
So the game, is it gonna be 2D or 3D?
Neither, because it's a desktop game. As in, you play it, and it's going to look like you're running a Linux system in a window, basically.
So it's technically 2D, right?
Yeah, it would be 2D. And at a rendering level, it is a 2D game, but it's not like it's not a platform or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's literally, you boot it up, and it looks like a desktop. Mm-hmm. And it looks like an operating system, and you treat it like a virtual computer, and then you can hack other virtual computers through it. And eventually, I plan to add multiplayer, so you can hack other players. But, you know, I'm one person, and I can't afford to, you know, set up online multiplayer on my own. So that's a little ways away. But, you know, that's something I would like to add to the game, is multiplayer support.
I'm kind of curious. So it's gonna look like a Linux desktop. Do you have to, like... Because I don't know the ins and outs of this, but like, do you have to develop or do you have to make like graphics for that, like a front end? How does that? I don't know how that works. I've never played Hacknet either, so I'm not sure.
As a player, you don't have to make a graphical front end for it. That's my job as a developer. But yeah, I do have to actually design every in-game program by hand. I can't just run Linux software in the game. It's not actually Linux. It is pretending to be Linux.
Wow.
So, like, I have this big Figma project of, like, all the different UI designs for all the programs, and I even have like screenshots of Windows and Linux distros and macOS to go off of for that.
Do you make those?
Because I'm not great with designing UI, but I don't really have anyone to help out with it.
Hmm.
I mean, I have one friend and he does help out occasionally with it. He's awesome. But, you know, sometimes I'm the only one awake. He can't help me. And, you know, it would be nice to be able to do things at that moment that I need it instead of waiting on someone else to wake up because we're in different time zones. So I do most of the UI design myself.
So you're basically making your own operating system then?
Using
Linux, pretty much.
I wouldn't use that term. I'd say operating environment.
Okay.
Once you start saying operating system, it implies that it's an actual kernel that boots on the bare metal or in a virtual machine, and that's not what I'm doing. And I've had a lot of people criticize me in the past for saying that I'm making an operating system. In reality, I'm making an operating environment, which is something completely different. And I don't want to get that criticism anymore. So,
yeah, programmers can be stuck up sometimes in that way. Like, you say one term wrong and they'll flame you for it.
Oh, yeah. Just the other day, I got someone really confused because I told them I was working on this game and I was porting this Linux program to the game, a program called ST, Simple Terminal. And they're like, why are you porting ST to your game? Why not just make a fake terminal? And I'm like, that's what I'm doing. Yeah. I'm just basing it off this existing real terminal because I want it to behave in the same way.
You know what this game sounds like? And I think this is what Chug was referencing earlier. It's that deep web game, Welcome to the Game.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're talking about, where there are these fake programs and like a fake web browser. But then you also, I think maybe in the second one, you can get up and it's 3D, so you can walk around the room and go outside.
That's the game I was referring to. No, not There Is No Game. That is another game, but it's not.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's not that.
Actually, I've never played a game like that before. I've never played Hacknet, so this is all new to me. I actually didn't even know there were games like this.
Yeah, Hacknet's fun. It's been years since I've played that. It's one of the first games I got on Steam. But I actually played Welcome to the Game 1, which is pretty fun. It's kind of scary, actually, because like, you're browsing the deep web, and the goal is to, I don't remember the end goal, to find something on there, but you got to like talk to people and get links to various sites. If you do certain things wrong, your like location symbol will be turned on, and because people are tracking you, you can actually get kidnapped and stuff. People come into your house and kill you.
Wow.
So like,
wow, getting ideas.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. Like, you know, make sure you block the location, and if like something happens, you gotta mask it quickly and all that.
Wow.
But like, you get jump scared because the dude will like rip you from the computer in 3D and like put a bag over your head or something. It's a pretty tense game.
See, I wish I had a 3D modeler on the team.
Michael, I'm curious. So like, how what's the story gonna be for this? Because I know you mentioned, I think in our DMs, that you were like, I have a storyboard built out, but obviously it's not like, you know, massive, but what's like the general goal for the story, or as much as you can give us?
Very early on in development, so there's not really a concrete story, like I said, but the general idea is you play as a college student, someone going into computer networking and cybersecurity, and you get this internship, this really shady internship, but of course you don't know that yet. And you get onboarded, and your first task is to hack into some server the company runs and grab some executable they want you to get. And it turns out this executable is not what you want it to be, and you run it like they tell you to. It launches a ransomware attack, and it attacks the entire country you live in during the global pandemic. It starts attacking hospitals, and the police track it down to you, and You have to clear your name and, you know, stop the ransomware attack. You launched it, but obviously you didn't do it intentionally and someone tricked you into launching it. And you have to, basically the entire story revolves around stopping the ransomware attack and holding the people who wrote it and who caused you to launch it accountable and making sure that you don't get arrested.
Sounds interesting.
So,
and where is this game going to be? Where can we play it once you actually fully release it? Which is,
it
you
is,
said it's not going to
be. It is going to be on Steam, on all major operating systems, macOS, Windows, and Linux. And it's not going to run under Proton. It's going to be native. The only thing it won't run on is a Steam Deck. I'm actually going to add a check into the game that detects Steam Deck hardware. And if you don't have a mouse and keyboard plugged in, it's just not going to let you play because it's not going to run well. You need a keyboard.
I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd want to play that with the keyboard built in. That would be so annoying.
Yeah.
Touchpad. Oh, yeah. If you're punching things into a terminal during a timed hacking mechanic on an on-screen keyboard, you're just going to fail. Just don't try.
How advanced is the autofill going to be? Because I know Hacknet, you put in like three letters once you get to know the in-game code and then hit tab and it autofills it. Is it going to have that, or is everything from scratch?
From a UX perspective, I do want autofill, and I do want tab completion. There's a lot of technical aspects to it that need to be worked out first. One of the big hurdles was performance, oddly enough, because the in-game terminal is based on ST, like I said, and ST is not designed to run in a game engine. It's designed to run on a Linux system. It's designed to run under Xorg. Xorg works fundamentally different from how a game engine does. And so I've had to optimize the port of ST in the game, the terminal, to work more with Unity and run a lot better. Now I've got it at 60 FPS solid, which is great. But with autocomplete and stuff like that, you need to be able to read what the player is typing as they type it, and you need to know what they're trying to run, what they mean to run. You kind of have to make guesses as well. And you need to build this context that you can go in and search through what's available in the game for the player to run and what things they know about and what's unlocked, what's basically runnable by the player and what makes sense to run at that given time. And you need to parse through all that and sort through it and find a completion. Then you have to render it on screen to make sure the player can see what they're doing. And then, you know, because the real terminal based on ST, you need to learn NZ escape sequences, which if you haven't learned NZ escape sequences, thank God, they are not fun. But they're how you make the cursor move around and stuff like that, and how you draw things on screen and all that wonderful stuff. And it's really annoying. But, you know, tab completion is something I have planned, so don't worry.
Yeah, so that's the terminal. So how does the social engineering aspect come in? Is there going to be a fake social media website?
Oh yeah, there is.
And then maybe like built in SMS messaging and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, is the social media cool. going to be called like InstaFace or something stupid like that?
I mean, it was gonna, or the placeholder name is Grapevine right now, but you know, InstaFace does sound better.
It's kind of funny, actually, InstaFace.
But yeah,
so
there will be.
Where can people support your game? Like, do you have a Discord for it? Do you have maybe like a Patreon, or, you know, where can people support you for that?
So right now I'm working on getting the Steam store page set up and running. Until then, it's not visible on Steam, but it is coming to Steam. If you want to actually check out the game and what it's going to look like and all that stuff, sociallydistantgame.com. It's a website I run. I do monthly dev logs on my personal Patreon for the game. The way it works is the exact same as Restitched Recapped, if you're familiar with Trixel Plus. You get the, if you're a Trixel Plus member, you get the post a week early than anyone else. It's the same thing for Socially Distant. If you support me on Patreon, you get dev logs a week early. And that's the best way, honestly, because, you know, I'm doing this alone right now, and I can manage most of the game on my own for free. Unity Personal is free. I pay out of pocket for my IDE. I have all the tools I need. But there are certain things, music licensing, you know, commissioning artists and graphic designers and UI designers and all that stuff for their time, that costs money. So that's a really good way to help me out, is actually being able to give me the money I need to be able to pay for things. And also, I have a YouTube channel. I don't post on it often because making videos is kind of difficult for me. But I'm usually on there showing something off in Socially Distant or some other programming project I'm working on. And there is a Discord, and that is the best way to stay up to date with actual development, because I log every code change I make in the game to the Discord server. There's a channel where every Git commit message is just there to look at. You can see the development happening live, and sometimes I even hop into voice chat and stream myself working on the game.
And all these links can be found on the website, right? The Patreon, the Discord, and the YouTube?
Oh, yeah. So. If the links don't work, then let me know. I need to fix them, but they should all be there.
So sociallydistantgame.com.
Yep.
Okay.
It's probably early on right now, but do you have an anticipated release window?
No idea. It could be years, honestly. Because I work a lot on restitch, that takes up a lot of my time. And even if I can get the game fully working in terms of programming and just functionality, it also needs to look presentable, and that's a challenge when you're blind. So that's going to take time, and also it needs to be written in terms of story and NPC dialogue, and then it needs to be tested, which is going to take a while. But I will confirm right now, there will be an open testing period for the game, so you know, look out for that. There will be an opportunity for people to be able to play the game early. I don't know if I'll go through Steam early access because there's restrictions on how that works, but I will figure something out.
When do you think you'll have the Steam page ready? Because this podcast will go out next week.
Mm-hmm. Well, bad news is it won't be ready by then. The reason for that is one of the requirements for the Steam page is you need to have 5 in-game screenshots, and they cannot be concept art, they cannot be marketing material, they have to be actual screenshots of the game in action. And that involves programming the game first and foremost, and it also makes it look, or involves making it look presentable, because you need to see what's on screen. It needs to be legible, and you know, when you're building an operating system game, that's not exactly trivial.
It is an operating system game then.
Yeah. I kind of went back on my whole operating environment thing. It's pretending to be an operating system, but, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, this game seems like it's something that I would enjoy a lot. I haven't played any game like Hacknet since. I never played Uplink, but I've heard that was really good. But I'm definitely going to be following development on this one for sure.
I'm very flattered to hear that. I am very awkward right now. Oh my God.
No, don't worry.
You're fine. So we have some questions kind of to somewhat close it out, because we talked about Restitch. We talked about Socially Distant. So we have some questions, in relation to, you know, the blindness and some other ones. So. I guess I'll start off with, you know, with everything that you do and the extent of what you do, what are your biggest hurdles that you would say?
Reading. Reading is the biggest one. And also, first setting up a computer, that's a big challenge. And, you know, doing anything in the game that's visual is also a challenge. Reading, a lot of people don't understand why I struggle with reading but can navigate a UI so well. The reason is one of the symptoms of my blindness is something called nystagmus, and if you know what that word means, then you know exactly what it looks like. But if you don't know what that means, basically, it's a condition where your eyes move back and forth on their own without you controlling it. So they twitch back and forth really rapidly, and it makes the whole world look like it's spinning. And I struggle with reading because unless it's like one or two words at a time and the contrast is really well, I have to spend a lot of time and energy focusing in on the text, keeping my eyes still because they're moving involuntarily. And I'm spending so much energy concentrating on that I can't really understand what I'm reading. So it's, I can't comprehend a lot of large sentences and I need to use the screen reader instead. That's been a big challenge. It almost actually ended my programming career because it got that bad. But I struggled through learning how to program a tool that lets me select and highlight text and read it aloud in my IDE. So I've solved that problem, thankfully. But the other challenge, like I said, is setting up the computer for the first time. If Windows blows itself up on me, or I'm on Linux and something isn't working quite right, my solution is not to try to salvage that system. That'll be impossible. I have to completely restart, blow everything out, transfer all my files off, back them up, and reinstall. And I get made fun of a lot in Trixel for constantly switching operating systems every week, but I have not been able to find an OS that just works perfectly for me. It works the way that I need it to. And then every time I need to set up a new OS, it's this huge challenge because I can't read the installer.
Wow.
What additional tools? I mean, I know you said that you made your own thing that where you could highlight text and it actually like reads it, like text to speech.
Yeah.
But what other tools do you have that help you make programming easier?
So that tool I mentioned, that only works in the JetBrains IDEs and in Visual Studio if I decide to use Visual Studio, which I never do. But that tool was inspired by another tool that I have for Google Chrome. I can't remember what the extension is called, but it's an extension you can install that lets you do the exact same thing, but on the internet. You select a piece of text, you right-click it, and there's a button that says read aloud selected text, and it reads it aloud most of the time. The one problem with it is it likes to detect the language of the text, like if it's French or Russian or Japanese or something like that, and it really struggles with source code, which is most of what I read on the internet. And sometimes it just flat out gives up and says, I can't read this. But sometimes it'll throw on some really, really obnoxious accented TTS voice because it thinks it's a different language, and that's why is that a feature I can't turn off? But you know, that's better than not being able to read the internet at all. Along with that, I use Dark Reader. Many people might be familiar with it, but you know, if you're not, it's an extension you install, and it takes a website that normally doesn't support dark mode and just generates a dark mode for it on the fly. And you can customize the contrast and the brightness and everything. And I have the contrast set really high on it. And it works really well for a lot of things like Trello, most documentation websites, YouTube, GitHub, Twitter, all the important stuff that I use. It does struggle with Patreon. It struggles with banking websites. It struggles with government websites, but most of what I use works perfectly fine with it. And then for zooming into the screen, which is another thing I do, I just use the Windows magnifier if I'm on Windows. On macOS, there's a desktop zoom you can enable. I can't remember how to enable it. It might be enabled by default, I think. But you know, that's the thing you can do. On Linux, I stick to the KDE desktop environment, and it has a zoom feature built into it, and they all work the exact same way. They zoom into the screen, full screen. It doesn't use like a magnifying lens or something like that like they used to in back in my day. Everything's gone to full screen magnification, which is really handy for me. And the last thing that I use is, as a last resort, Windows Narrator VoiceOver. and whatever desktop environment screen reader is supported on Linux, that's a last resort because it will read everything. It'll read menus. It'll read buttons. It'll try to read icons. And sometimes I just don't need it to.
Mm.
But if something's really not working, I'll go to that and it'll work most of the time.
Have you had to set your PC setup differently than people usually have it set up?
Oh, absolutely. For example, with the magnifier, the way to zoom in is there's two ways. You can either do it with the UI where you have a window open and there's a zoom button you can use. That's the obvious way. But the other way is with a hotkey, Windows key, and the equals key to zoom in, and then the hyphen key to zoom out. But for me, that's annoying to use because I would like to be able to keep my hand on the mouse while I'm typing so I can pan around as I'm typing. So I have a special hotkey. I have the Logitech G600 mouse. It's one of those gaming mouses. And it has like an entire numpad worth of buttons on the side of it that can be programmed. And I have some of them programmed for zooming in and zooming out. I have an Alt-Tab button, which is fairly common. And then I have a toggle color inversion button. And then that's really handy. And also I have dual monitors, but I don't use them as dual monitors. I use them as one giant monitor. But I also don't have it set up with NVIDIA Surround or anything like that. It's just the way that Windows Magnifier works. It treats multiple monitors as one giant screen. And that allows me to have all the real estate of two 4K monitors, which is a lot. But I can zoom into the screen and read things. And, you know, I actually have like four computers in front of me right now. I have my main computer, I have my Mac Mini, and I have my Steam Deck, and I have a file server that I use. And it's a little absurd, but what that actually got me to do is it got me to get a KVM switch. And that means that I can plug my PS5 and PS3 into it. And I can use mouse and keyboard on those for Little Big Planet because I struggle to read the on-screen keyboards. So if I need to type something in on PlayStation, I use my keyboard. And also, with that said, the other weird thing about my setup is I don't play my PS3 or PS5 on a TV or on a monitor directly. I actually play it through a preview window, through my capture card, through OBS, and I pipe the audio through to my headset so I can hear it. And what that lets me do is, even though the PS5 has accessibility tools now, you can zoom into it and it's got high contrast and color inversion, all that stuff, that's great. PS3 does not. You know, you're not zooming into that. I don't even think you could handle that. So I can use that preview window in OBS to be able to zoom into the screen and to be able to use color inversion if I need to. And worst comes to worst, hop on a Discord call and phone a friend to be a second pair of eyes when I'm playing LBP or something like that, which has been really helpful. But it's a weird thing about my setup. It means if my computer's not working, there's no PlayStation for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what could software developers do for, you know, what could they do to increase accessibility? Because obviously we've seen over the years that this has become more important. Like you said, with the PS3, you can't do any of that kind of stuff. So like, what can software developers do for the future to increase accessibility, you know, as we move forward with this?
All right. Linux distro devs, make sure your speech dispatcher config is working out of box. If you don't know what I mean, don't worry about it. Basically how the screen reader works on Linux. Web developers, test your website in Dark Reader and make sure it actually becomes fully dark. Figma has a problem where plugins don't go dark for me, or if they do, UI elements end up being black text on a black background, which is unusable. Some websites, they just don't go dark at all. Patreon, a lot of the icons in the UI don't get affected by dark readers, so they stay black and I can't see them. And, you know, with Patreon, that's even more important for me to be able to read, because I shouldn't need to phone a friend to help me put a post public when that post is behind a paywall. I'm now leaking the post to someone who's not paying for it. That's not fun for me. And also, test your website with a screen reader. Do not assume that whatever UI library you're using is going to take care of it for you. They do a somewhat good job if your UI is simple, but when your UI becomes more advanced, something like Google Docs or Google Sheets, Trello, the built-in solutions are not going to work well. You need to actually tailor your UI to work with a screen reader, and you should be doing it, because sometimes being able to zoom in is not enough. There are some people who cannot see, period. Everything's black or everything's too blurry. You need to test for screen reader support. You can't just assume that it'll work, because oftentimes it won't work well enough. Hmm. And game developers, what I want you to do is test your game with a screen magnifier, because what a lot of games that I play do is they capture the mouse cursor and they prevent it from moving. Their game engine will have its own internal mouse cursor that moves around with mouse movement, and it hijacks the system one. And that works great until you need to zoom into the screen, because now Windows or whatever OS you're using is completely unaware that your mouse is moving, because the game is taking it over. And so I try to zoom into like a crafting menu or an inventory, trying to read an item description, and I can't get it on screen because my mouse is stuck in the top left corner or in the middle or something like that. And it's just likely because the game hasn't been tested in a screen magnifier scenario. And then the other issue with it is on the opposite of end of the spectrum is some games use exclusive full screen and only support exclusive full screen. It's a problem with older games, especially. Those will not work with a screen magnifier because the magnifier will not render. Those will be turned off by Windows.
Mm-hmm.
So with those games, unless your UI has really large font, I can't play them because I cannot find the menu item to turn off exclusive full screen. So in those cases, please add an F11 hotkey and let me get out of full screen.
Yeah.
So I can zoom in.
I think most people hate that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. In modern games, that shouldn't be an issue.
I can see if you have a singular monitor, you don't entirely need to. I mean,
it would still be annoying if you want to alt tab.
Well, yeah, if you want to alt tab, yeah, it'll have to decrease it. But if you borderless windowed is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, on other platforms than Windows, borderless windowed is the only form of full screen you have. There is no exclusive full screen on Linux. There is none on macOS. It is a Windows thing, and it is a horrible Windows thing.
Mm. Yeah. So one final question. How can someone similar to you get into game development or just programming in general?
So, first of all, I, as blunt as it is, be lucky, because with my condition, especially once you get to a certain point, it's just not feasible to learn from scratch. So if you're at a young age and really interested in programming, use your school computers, use the computer lab. Use, if you are lucky enough to have a laptop that isn't a Chromebook, use that. A lot of schools, if they're actually decent, will have programming tools on the computer's image because they probably have programming courses. You know, if they do have programming courses, take them. Because even if the teacher, let's be honest, a lot of public school programming courses are not great. I've taken them. They are most likely just carbon copies of what you can find on YouTube. But you have that environment where you're free to try things out. So use it. if you have a college that does dual credits, see if they have game dev courses, because that'll give you more of a chance, and you can have people there to help you when you're struggling to see. But when it comes to self-teaching, the most important thing to learn is how to Google. And that goes for not being blind as well. That's programming in general. Learn how to Google things. But also don't be ashamed of it. Don't be ashamed of copying someone else's code into your project while you're learning. It's fine. Just don't publish it. Or if you do, publish with credit. But what I will say is, when it comes to picking an IDE, that's going to be your struggle point, because not all IDEs are built the same. You know, some programmers swear by Visual Studio, some by Visual Studio Code, some by the JetBrains IDEs, some use Vim. Find your IDE, shop around, find one you're comfortable with and stick with it, and learn how to extend it, learn how to write plugins for it, because if you have a condition like mine, that is going to save your ass when you lose your ability to read. Trust me. Happened to me in the past. So, you know, learn an IDE and stick with it. Don't think that because everyone says Vim is the best, use Vim. Like, no, don't fall into that trap. And don't fall into everyone uses Linux, so you should use Linux. If you're comfortable with Windows, use Windows. If you're comfortable with macOS, use macOS. Don't let other people dictate what software you use. And finally, when you're interacting with communities, a lot of software development communities, especially in Discord, they don't expect people to be blind when you go into them, but they will accommodate you. So don't be afraid to explain, hey, I'm struggling to read this piece of code, or, you know, this image, I need it described to me. Just be polite about it and people will accommodate you. And I actually had this happen recently where I was having some trouble on Linux or something, and I needed to open a support thread on a Discord server, and the forum UI for Discord is horrible when it comes to accessibility. Like, there's no way to use it for me. And someone else, because they knew about my condition, they realized I would struggle with it, and they opened up a thread for me and helped me out. And that was really nice of them. And that was only because I was comfortable enough to explain that I'm struggling with the condition, and they helped me. But also, the last thing I will say is, look for, and this is when you're actually a moderately decent programmer, look for volunteer opportunities. Look for developers who may need some help. People like Trixel Creative, maybe even me. But it obviously doesn't have to be us, but, you know, anyone, if there's a game that you think would be interesting to contribute, and, you know, maybe you're thinking, I'm blind, I'm going to struggle with this. Okay, maybe you will, but you'll struggle. It won't be impossible. So give it a try and you'll learn stuff. You'll have other people you can talk to and who will help you. And that was the experience that I have with Trixel. I almost didn't join the restitch team because I thought I wouldn't be able to do it all blind. But, you know, I took the chance, and now I'm one of the lead programmers. So obviously something worked out. Most of the time it will.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's not something you hear every day, but it's great that there are people accommodating for it, and that you're able to help other people who might be in the same situation, but not as lucky as you said to be able to get into stuff early on.
I think the other thing is, you know, not even for people. Obviously, you know, you are the, you know, you're someone who made it and is doing well programming despite, you know, being blind. But this is also good for those of you who are listening and thinking, you know, wanting to get into programming or wanting to get into 3D modeling or whatever it may be. This is kind of a, there are no excuses type of, you know, situation where it's like, you know, Michael here pushed through it all and is continuing to learn, continuing to better himself. So if you're wanting to pursue it, then there's really no excuse. You just got to put yourself to it.
So. Yeah, it will be tough for sure. I mean, there are disadvantages to being disabled, whether it be blind or deaf or whatnot. You know, that's why it's called a disability. You do have a limited ability to do certain things. That's obvious, but it's called disability, not incapability. So you're not incapable of doing certain things. Mm. You're just going to have a harder time, and that's okay. People will help you. You just have to try. And, you know, if you're struggling, ask for help. Don't be afraid. People will help you. And another piece of advice I can give to programmers is comment your code. Seriously, comment your code, because even if you're not blind, you'll have trouble understanding it in 6 months. But if you are blind, you're going to have a real hard time reading the code in the first place to understand what you were thinking. But with a comment, you can pop that in a screen reader and it'll read the sentence in English. But a screen reader trying to read computer code, not going to run very well.
That must be a nightmare.
Oh yeah, it is. Luckily for me, I still can see the color and the general layout of the code, even if I can't read it. So, you know, when a screen reader skips over like a curly brace or something, I can still see the curly brace there. So I know it's there. But if you're past that point where you can see that, you're going to want to comment your code a lot and make sure you describe what it does as you're writing it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's not going to be fun to come back to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even if it's your own code, you won't understand it in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Especially if it's your own code, because if it's someone else's code, then they probably understand it. You can ask them. But if it's your own code, you can only ask yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, you can't answer that question.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think that's about it for everything we have on here. Are we going to do Q&A or is it a bit late?
We haven't had YouTube open. I'm not sure. Ben.
Yeah, we haven't been looking at the chat.
Ben? Oh, you can't? Okay. All right. Well, then we'll just leave it there then.
Thanks for joining us, Michael. It was great having you on the podcast.
Oh, what is it? Let me see. Sociallydistantgame.com for those who want to support Michael. His Discord, his YouTube is on there. And I'm sure, and your Patreon, and I'm sure that you will give everyone an update when your game is on Steam so people can wishlist it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right, so I think that's going to be it for today. Thank you, everyone, for watching CubeldCast. We'll see you in the next episode.